This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Supreme Court blocks one of President Biden's vaccine mandates while leaving the other intact as moderate senators stand up in defense of the filibuster. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, editorial writer Jason Willick and columnist Kim Strassel. On Thursday, the Supreme Court issued two emergency docket rulings, and let's start with the bigger of the two. It blocked a vaccine or testing mandate from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. This is a mandate that applied to every business with 100 or more employees, about 84 million people in all. And the ruling is unsigned, but it appears to be a 6-3 decision. And Jason, to me, that suggests a strong majority of the court here thinks that the Biden administration was overstepping its powers.
Yep. I mean, what they say at the beginning is what's sort of intuitive, which is that OSHA, the Occupational Health and Safety Administration, is supposed to regulate occupational safety. And the vaccine mandate didn't really have any relationship to a place of work, you know, depending on what your work is. It was just a broad mandate on anybody over 100 employees. As we'll discuss, that was a little bit different in the second case they decided, but that's exactly right. They're saying, you know, the OSHA statute, the law that Congress passed to give the executive authority to regulate workplaces was not intended to cover a requirement that workers get a vaccine or this vaccine.
And that goes to this major questions doctrine, which is that the Supreme Court thinks if an administrative agency is going to exercise a power like that, Congress better have clearly delegated that power. A couple other things I would pull out from the court's unsigned opinion there, Kim, is this line, first of all, where it says the exemptions that OSHA gives are largely illusory. And apparently there were some exemptions for people who work outdoors, but they were so narrow that the opinion says only 9% of landscapers and groundskeepers qualify. And that just shows the breadth of what OSHA was trying to do here. Another thing I would point out is the court's opinion says that we recognize that OSHA could probably do some sort of more narrowly tailored rule. It says specifically something involving workplaces that have crowded or cramped environments. But Kim, basically, OSHA didn't want to do that. Basically, OSHA did something that applied to every workplace with more than 100 people, no matter what it looks like. There's another line in the opinion I liked. It says, most lifeguards and linemen face the same regulations as do medics and meat packers, unquote. And that's what the Supreme Court said OSHA doesn't have the power to do.
Yes, let us count the many, many ways that OSHA violated the law that was in this opinion. As Jason noted, the major questions doctrine exceeding its statutory authority. What you're talking about is the finding by the court that OSHA had violated administrative law by not in any way tailoring this mandate to workplace risk. And that is a fundamental doctrine out there that when administrative agencies do act, they have an obligation to create rules in the narrowest and most finely tuned way that they can. And as you said, this was just a huge mandate, 84 million Americans treating every single occupation essentially the same way. And as a result, it wasn't just that this was struck down narrowly, but there was a whole list of things that the court sent a message to OSHA on that it had violated. And the good news here is that it's not just if the court had gone the other way, it would have opened up regulators to essentially do anything under the guise of an emergency. Conversely, by running through the list of things that this agency did incorrectly, it sent a message to the Biden administration and other regulators there that it's going to need to tread a lot more carefully in its rulemaking.
So we'll give the dissent a word here. There were the dissent is for the three liberal justices. The opinion's written by Justice Stephen Breyer. A couple things I'll pick out that he says. He said the statute does not require that employees are exposed to those dangers only while on the workplace clock. So his argument is that there's nothing in the OSHA Authorizing Act that says they can only regulate dangers that happen occupationally in the workplace and not elsewhere. He also has this line, if OSHA's standard is far-reaching, applying to many millions of American workers, it no more than reflects the scope of the crisis, unquote. And Jason, I wonder how you'd respond to that.
Well, I would tie it into the discussion that the president and the Congress are having about democracy and what it means to have a democracy. You know, it's not just about voting rules. It's also about that if you're compelled to do something, it goes through a process. It goes through your elected representatives. It's not just dictated to you by the executive. So that really, you know, Justice Breyer is saying, well, there's a crisis. There's a broad crisis. We should construe this broadly. But, you know, we live in a democracy, which means that Congress has to pass laws when we're going to be compelled to do something by the government. I mean, as you said, you can construe statutes like this extremely broadly or extremely narrowly. John Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, frustrated a lot of conservatives by blocking some of President Trump's initiatives, including on the census, basically saying he didn't go through the administrative procedure as carefully as possible, as Kim was alluding to. So, you know, these justices, I think, you know, Justice Gorsuch would probably read these authorizing statutes very narrowly. Justice Breyer would read them more broadly. But ultimately, six justices said, nah, you're going too far. That's not consistent with our constitutional principles.
Another thing I thought was interesting to see over the past several weeks is the different views on the court on display when it comes to the risk that COVID poses. And on one side, you have Justice Neil Gorsuch, who has been noted lately as the only justice who is participating in person in oral arguments, who is going out, sitting on the bench, and choosing not to wear a mask. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She made headlines for making this claim during oral arguments, has gotten some pushback on it. Listen to this.
Those numbers show that Omicron is as deadly and causes as much serious disease in the unvaccinated as Delta did. We have over 100,000 children, which we've never had before, in serious condition, and many on ventilators.
So she has been called on that in a lot of different places, different fact checkers. Apparently, the real number is there are fewer than 5,000 kids in hospitals with COVID-19, and a lot of them are probably in there for other reasons, and then they get tested when they go there, and turns out that they do have COVID-19. But Kim, it's been interesting to see this spectrum of views of COVID, and with respect to Justice Sotomayor, I wonder where she gets her news, and I would put in a little pitch for a subscription to the Wall Street Journal here.
My own view on this is it says something just about how highly politicized COVID has become, that even the court can't escape it. And in addition to those examples you mentioned, so all of the controversy over the fact that Gorsuch is coming out without a mask, or all of the notation of the fact that Sotomayor won't appear in person, it was interesting listening to Justice Alito during the arguments, and he wanted to make a point about the vaccines and the fact that they're effective to people even outside of the workplace. And he went to these extreme lengths to tell everyone that he wasn't doubting the vaccines. Really, he wasn't doubting the vaccines, and he doesn't want to be misconstrued. And he must have said it like six times. And it just, again, it says something about how toxic this debate has become, that people have chosen sides over issue, like essentially a respiratory disease. And it's just a bizarre reflection on the moment. Yes, Justice Sotomayor also brings up the perils that we are now facing with these live oral arguments, in that it turns out justices get things wrong too. But because their voice is always taken with such authority, it is a little bit more shocking when they do get things wrong, and it is live cast across the country. Not a high moment for Justice Sotomayor, because it does make you wonder about the people who are writing these opinions and how well informed they are, I guess. But it has at least been corrected.
But the Supreme Court was not live streaming its arguments before the pandemic. That started during the pandemic and has continued when the justices got back to in-person arguments. But I think this is an example of the downsides of it. It offers people, justices, lawyers making their arguments, an opportunity, a bigger opportunity than they had before to do a little grandstanding. And the point that Kim brings up about that moment with Justice Alito too, where I was struck by that as well. He said maybe four or five times, "I'm not questioning the efficacy of these vaccines." Jason, if you wonder why the justices don't want cameras in their courtrooms, it seems like we've had a pretty good example in the past few weeks.
Yeah, certainly. You know, and Justice Sotomayor also at the Dobbs versus Mississippi case regarding abortion just a few months ago also distinguished herself with sort of some rather polarizing remarks. Maybe they weren't false, but they were more political than we're used to hearing. I think that's a testament to the environment that we're in. I personally like having these oral arguments streamed in an audio feed live so I can listen to them, but I'm not sure it's good for the court. I mean, you know, I've just been watching a bunch of trials this year covering Kyle Rittenhouse trial, the Ahmaud Arbery killing trial. You know, these are similar where you've got state judges, not Supreme Court justices, but state judges, you know, they have cameras in their courtroom pretty often. It's sort of, but it's only in very rare instances when the whole country is watching. And in fact, you had the judge in the Kyle Rittenhouse case say afterward he's going to have second thoughts about bringing cameras into the courtroom given the distortions of his rulings that were happening in the press. But with the Supreme Court, of course, it's not just, you know, once in your career as a judge that you have a case of tremendous public interest, but it's every time or almost every time.
One last thought on this OSHA ruling. There's also an opinion written by Justice Neil Gorsuch, joined by Justices Thomas and Alito, and it goes a little bit further than the court's opinion goes. And there's a line where it says, even if OSHA had this power, even if Congress tried to grant this power, that law would likely constitute an unconstitutional delegation of legislative authority, unquote. And Kim, can you just explain what is the significance of that?
You bet, because I live for the moments when I get to geek out on the non-delegation doctrine. It's so exciting. But essentially, so the non-delegation doctrine is this constitutional doctrine that says Congress can delegate its powers or essentially outsource its powers to government agencies, but only if it gives those agencies very, very clear and specific directions about what actions to take. And this used to be a doctrine that the Supreme Court relied on to strike down a whole bunch of lawsuits up until about up until about the 1930s. And then the FDR era happened and it has really fallen out of style. It hasn't really been used. But when you combine that, this doctrine, the fact that Congress now just delegates willy-nilly all the time to agencies, and you combine it with this other Supreme Court precedent, the Chevron doctrine, which says that courts have to give bureaucrats deference in the decisions they make, you essentially suddenly understand how we have the rise of this entire nation that is basically run by bureaucrats and all of these administrative rules and regulations these days that just multiply by the second. And so you've seen a number of courts that have begun to revive the non-delegation doctrine, mostly lower ones. You clearly now have three Supreme Court justices that are suggesting they'd like to revive it. And while they didn't get their way in this case, what is notable is that there are a number of other cases coming along, in particular a case that the Supreme Court said in October it would hear having to do with EPA powers and bureaucratic powers. It lays the groundwork for, it's very clear that you're going to have some of these justices working very hard to try to get Kavanaugh and Chief Justice Roberts over to their side and maybe revive this doctrine.
Hang tight, we'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Let's talk briefly about the other Supreme Court ruling. This is the one involving the mandate on about 10 million healthcare workers. And the Biden administration's power here, or its purported power, is from the funding of Medicare and Medicaid. Health facilities get that funding, and the argument is that the Secretary of Health can put some conditions on that funding. And so this was a 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court. And Jason, here at least it seems to me a closer call. You're talking about people who are working in a healthcare facility, and so we're not talking about landscapers anymore, at least.
Yeah, you know, it's too bad that, you know, people on both sides who either want the vaccine mandate or don't sort of get angry at the Supreme Court because it didn't give them all of what they wanted in either case. But they're totally different cases, right? They're different authorizing statutes. The Supreme Court is not deciding, you know, a mood affiliation about vaccine mandates, whether it likes it or not. It's looking at the OSHA statute for the OSHA regulation, and it's looking at a congressional statute related to medical and Medicaid services for hospitals that get funding from those federal programs. So it's interpreting two different statutes, and it interpreted basically that the OSHA statute did not give the administration this authority, but the statute regarding Medicare and Medicaid did give this authority. So they're different statutes, and I think it makes sense to distinguish between them.
Well, the majority opinion essentially says there are all sorts of other examples of conditions that is put on this Medicare-Medicaid funding. Apparently, there's a long-running requirement that healthcare providers maintain an infection prevention and control program. So they're saying this is similar to the vaccine mandate that the Biden administration wants to put forward. Then there's the dissent by Justice Clarence Thomas. He says that I don't see anywhere in these laws where you could read it broad enough to include a vaccine mandate on 10 million people. He says essentially what the government is doing is it's taking these hodgepodge of provisions and trying to put a vaccine mandate that doesn't really fit under them in them. So Kim, I don't know if you had a read of which way you'd go on this one.
Yeah, the specific line from the Thomas dissent is he accuses the government, he says it, quote, fell back on a constellation of statutory provisions that each concern one of the 15 types of medical facilities that the rule covers, end quote. So what the minority is essentially accusing the majority of doing is really scraping around to try to cobble together the authority to do this and, as it were, split the difference. I actually think that the dissenters have the better reading of this law and are correct in there, and I would have liked to have seen that mandate struck down as well. But I do have to give it this, that at least the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Service statute has some connection to health regulations. And obviously vaccines fall in there. So overall, I'll take this as good news for the country. The OSHA mandate was really egregious, really went over the line. This one, as you can see from the fact that Roberts and Kavanaugh were on board, it was a closer call. But overall, this was a real brushback and warning to the Biden administration.
Finally, President Biden's push for a national election code has seemed like a long shot for a while, but it ran into new hurdles, or I guess maybe they're old hurdles, on Thursday when moderate senators began saying that they were not going to dismantle the Senate's filibuster rule in order to pass this legislation. And one of them is Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema. Here's part of what she said.
And while I continue to support these bills, I will not support separate actions that worsen the underlying disease of division infecting our country. The debate over the Senate 60-vote threshold shines a light on our broader challenges. There's no need for me to restate my longstanding support for the 60-vote threshold to pass legislation. There's no need for me to restate its role protecting our country from wild reversals in federal policy.
And Jason, that's news, of course, because she said it in the midst of this push by President Biden for this legislation. But to my eye, that is basically what Senator Sinema has been saying all along.
Yep. And she said it just as the president was arriving on the Hill to lobby for his legislation. So she effectively sort of took the wind out of some of his lobbying efforts, because it was being, you know, she was guaranteeing that there were not 50 votes to do this at the same time. It's absolutely what she said all along. Senator Manchin put out a similar statement with a rather exasperated tone, saying that he's not going to get rid of the filibuster either. So you've got at most 48 senators willing to do it. And You know, what I thought was especially significant about Kyrsten Sinema's speech, it was a speech saying we can disagree with each other in good faith. We've got to solve our problem of division. It was a window into what President Biden might have been saying instead of this outrageous sort of demagoguery that he was offering up in Georgia. If he was giving the speech Kyrsten Sinema was giving, I don't think Quinnipiac polls would be showing his approval at 33%. So she really underscored, not only did she kill his legislation, she underscored, frankly, why his presidency is flailing, in my view.
So, Kim, where does the push for this legislation stand as we sit here taping this on Friday? I know there have been some procedural maneuvers in the House and the Senate. And where do you think Chuck Schumer is intending to go with this over the next few days?
Well, the original plan was for the House to stuff the text of these bills into an unrelated vehicle to get it over to the Senate quickly. And they were going to have a big weekend showdown over this in which he brought up those bills. Republicans would presumably filibuster them. And then he would move to go nuclear and get rid of the legislative filibuster. Then you had the president come. You had Manchin and Sinema issue their statements. He went into a huddle in a back room and then suddenly came out and said, in fact, we have a snowstorm coming and people have COVID. So we're all just going to go home and we'll be back on Tuesday and then we'll deal with this then. I think that the leadership is taking a little break to continue game planning this out. It's also the case that there are some members out. And remember, when you have a 50-50 Senate, you need every last person on board if you are the majority to get that 50 plus Kamala Harris to move ahead. And so they might just have a logistical numerical problem at the moment because of COVID going on. But the reality is that even when they come back on Tuesday, this is going to be a defeat. And it might make some liberal senators feel better watching Manchin and Sinema have to take that vote on the floor, putting them in a difficult position. But it does nothing to move the caucus forward. And, you know, as a lot of very, very smart politicians have always noted in the past, the rule in Washington is that when a party is fighting among itself, it is losing. And the question is when the White House is going to understand this. And I know it needs to show its base that it's still trying, but it'd be far better for it to pivot somehow and get onto something that is more of a winning story.
But Jason, that raises the million-dollar question, which is why is the White House going down this road? Why is Chuck Schumer going down this road? If you already have two senators, at least, who are saying they're not going to vote to undermine the filibuster. To Kim's point, I thought the goal in partisan politics was to put the other guy in a difficult position. I mean, is it just that they're looking at the approval numbers and they're trying to keep their base fired up?
Yeah, I mean, the president is really advertising his impotence by you know, going to Georgia, trying to make headlines with a speech for a project that's doomed. You know, maybe he knows something we don't about some way he can get them on board, but it just doesn't look like it. I think the only answer you'd have to say is these people are just the administration is living in a bubble of sort of activist and donor pressure that has worked itself up into, you know, first, Build Back Better was the last chance in our history to save the climate. Now, this federal election code is the last chance to save our democracy. And I think, you know, that must be what they believe. Politics be damned. They think it's, you know, this is you know, politics doesn't matter because the stakes are so enormous, and this is like the Civil War and the rest of this, which is nonsense, and which is just going to tank them politically. But I can't think of any other explanation besides that the belief that they've talked themselves into is genuine, or alternatively, you know, as we mentioned in the last podcast, that by flogging this legislation, they can then say if it doesn't pass, that the next election is illegitimate, which they're worried about losing.
Thank you, Jason and Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. And if you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. Also, stay tuned. Next week, starting Monday, episodes will be available 5 days a week. We'll be back then with another edition of Potomac Watch.